welcome to this 12th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 6th chapter, part 1, which is titled Hell and Evil. Chapter 6, Hell and Evil. When we talk of hell, many think in terms of a great Hieronymus Bosch painting from the Middle Ages, where demons with pitchforks are tormenting sinners, and there are some who are bent over double with their heads up their posteriors. I love a good Bosch painting. They're so full of fancy and busyness. But they aren't a true depiction of the infernal regions, any more than sitting on a cloud and playing a harp forever accurately depicts heaven. The phrase lake of fire and brimstone, as used in the scriptures, is metaphorical, as we'll see as this chapter unfolds. First off, the common concepts of hell, as referred to above, are one of the main reasons many thinking people reject religion. God they can buy, heaven sounds nice, but hell? Eternal torment? Demons and pitchforks and burning lakes of fire and brimstone? Let's see if for a moment we can remove some of the baggage from the concepts of hell and evil and put them into rational terms. The picturesque and frightening concepts of hell weren't part of the original teachings of Jesus Christ, but crept into the church during the Middle Ages, as exemplified in such works as Dante's Inferno and Bosch's paintings, as mentioned, although some physical punishment ideas were also expressed by some of the early church martyrs. Unfortunately, probably because of its emotional impact on churchgoers, the eternal punishment doctrines took hold and have been an uninvited baggage to religion ever since. LDS Apostle James E. Talmage describes hell thus, quote, "Hell is no place to which a vindictive judge sends prisoners to suffer and to be punished principally for his glory. But it is a place prepared for the teaching, the disciplining of those who failed to learn here upon earth what they should have learned. No man will be kept in hell longer than is necessary to bring him in a fitness for something better. When he reaches that state, the prison doors will open, and there will be rejoicing among the hosts who welcome him into a better state." End quote. Conference Report, April 1930, page 97. Frederick W. Farrar, a canon at Westminster Abbey around 1877, wrote Mercy and Judgment, published in 1881, in which he took the eternal flames and punishment doctrines of the time to task. For example, here's what he was up against. Read this grim spectacle from Jonathan Edwards, an American minister in early colonial times. Quote, "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much in the same way as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. He will trample them beneath his feet with inexpressible fierceness. He will crush their blood out and will make it fly, so that it will sprinkle his garment and stain all his raiment." End quote. One might ask, where is the God who is love? 1 John chapter 4, verse 8. They further applied damnation to unbaptized infants, though some tried to soften it by saying it would be of very slight character. What? Only first-degree burns, like sunburns, on these innocent babes? Farrar argued in a theology known as the Wider Hope that such teachings as Edwards gave Christianity created, quote, "the perfect fear which casts out all love," end quote, on page 109. That's a play on the scripture in 1 John chapter 4, verse 18, which reads, "Perfect love casteth out fear." His research led him to the conclusion that hell, quote, "was originally formed not to express mere torture, but cleansing, correcting, delivering from the stain of sin," page 408. As to duration, quote, The death of the soul shall last as long as its willing sinfulness lasts, and its hell burn as long as its enmity to God continues. Hell and death are endless conditions so long as there is persistent impenitence. Page 482. And, quote, I believe that eternity has nothing to do with duration. So eternal life is God's own life. It is essential life. And eternal punishment is the misery belonging to the nature of the sin and not coming from outward sources. Page 395. Eternity consists not in endlessness, but in knowing, seeing, and loving God. To make it a synonym of time endlessly prolonged is a conception as mean in philosophy as it is false theologically. Page 398, previously cited. Farrar's idea of punishment and misery coming internally rather than externally, flames and such, is easier to conceptualize. Have you ever felt just plain dumb for something you've done? Ever wished you could wind time back and redo a particular act? For a small example with me, I once got a speeding ticket. As a truck driver, this went on my record and jeopardized my employment. Many is the time since I wished I could go back and bring my foot off the gas pedal just a bit to avoid that moment. I think it's the same with our status before God, and the repentance Farrar talks of is that true desire to do differently the next time around. But to me, the bottom line is that when we die, we'll be with people who are basically like us. I don't mean in terms of hobbies and career paths, hair or skin color, but rather moral equivalence, their outlook on life and subsequent approach to it. Emanuel Swedenborg seems to think along these lines, quote, "We construct our own interior heaven or hell while on earth, and are spiritually conjoined with a society in the other world whose members are like our true selves." End quote. Conversations with Angels, What Swedenborg Heard in Heaven, previously cited, page 13. For example, I'd like to think that where I go when I die, women will be able to walk in the evening and enjoy the aromas and sights of lovely night-blooming flowers without fear of being attacked or hassled. They'll be able to leave their homes unlocked with no worries of someone walking in while they're gone and going through their things. No one will be drunk or on drugs. Pornography won't exist. There will be ready and cheerful help when it is needed, for example, in moving from one place to another. Though I don't think money will be a part of these environs, it wouldn't matter. All financial dealings and agreements would be conducted with complete trust and honesty. Children will be loved and played with. The environment would be cherished, appreciated, and cared for. I seriously hope part of my activities in the next life will be coaching Little League Baseball. I did that for 5 years, and those were easily some of the happiest years of my life. I say with joy and fond memories that there was a time in my life, my adult life, when the 10-year-olds in our neighborhood who wanted to get up a baseball game would come by and ask me to play too. I'd put my computer on save and join them. Of course, I was the coach, had the equipment, and could drive them to the ball field, but I like to believe they wanted me to play with them anyway. And now we each must ask ourselves, if when I die, I go to a place where everyone is basically like me, will it be heaven or hell? Will I be able to trust my fellow residents? Will they be likable? Look in the mirror, not of your bathroom, but of your soul. There you will see your heaven or hell, your eternal reward. All life is eternal and can't be destroyed without its permission. So that life which is hostile and corrupting to other life around it, especially innocent life, must be removed to a place of its own where it can have the darkness and grossness it seems to desire. And it must be bound in so it can't escape and come back to corrupt the better part of the cosmos. We'd like to think evil doesn't exist in heaven, and it doesn't. However, there is a place in the cosmos for those who choose it, so obviously heaven doesn't include geographically the entire cosmos. Betty Eady's experience included a look at a group of angels called warring angels, embraced by the light previously cited, pages 90 through 91. Quote, "It was shown to me that their purpose is to do battle for us against Satan and his angels. There are times when the warring angels are necessary to protect us. They are giant men, very muscularly built, with a wonderful countenance about them. They were actually dressed like warriors, in headdress and armor, and I saw that they moved more swiftly than other angels. As they suddenly rushed off on some mission, I was moved by their looks of concern." Quote, "She got impressions of the great confidence and dedication of these angels in their fight against evil, a fight we must take literally, else why the armor and the apparently superb physical conditioning? And note their suddenly rushing off, their looks of concern. There is serious stuff going on in the cosmos, of which we'll all eventually take our part. We need to be prepared and not naive. Maybe these angels are going after galactic pirates. Yes, we're on the fringes here. But ancient records deal with the concept of the great storehouses and treasures in the heavens, not as in gold and jewels like Pirates of the Caribbean, but in the things that are taken to planets to make them habitable, such as plants and animals. Satan, incapable of creation, can only steal those things intended for the creations of God and use them for his own habitations. Quote, the devil and his host claim the treasure for their own and attempt to pirate the treasure ships that cruise between the worlds and use the loot in the outfitting of their own dark worlds. Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, previously cited, page 53. Nibley notes, page 69, cites several sources and archaic references to intergalactic pirating. For example, quote, when God sent forth a ship of light laden with the riches of the living, Satan and his pirate crew coming, I know not from where, seized the treasure of the Mighty One and distributed it among their worlds until they were forced to give it up. Our friends in the Navy SEALs need to keep their training up to date. There will be places for them in the cosmos. Jordan Peterson, previously cited, writes as to why hell may be considered a bottomless pit, page 367. Quote, nothing is going so badly that it can't be made worse. In the most awful of cases, the terrible suffering of unfortunate souls becomes attributable, by their own judgment, to mistakes they made knowingly in the past, acts of betrayal, deception, cruelty, carelessness, cowardice, and most commonly of all, willful blindness. Think in terms of vaccine deniers, flat earth people, Holocaust deniers. Willful blindness. To suffer terribly and to know yourself as the cause, that is hell. And on the other side of the coin, will the residents be self-righteous and judgmental? Are they thinking now that I'll go to hell for what I've written? Do they gloat when they think of their imagined eternal rewards and the rest of us burning in a literal lake of fire and brimstone? Do they have the not-so-secretive smugness of the Pharisee, who in Luke 18:11-12 prayed, quote, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. If God keeps me out of such company, I may not be in heaven, but a true paradise it will be. And let's deal quickly with those filled with pride and immaturity who claim they'd rather rule in hell than be a servant in heaven. Okay, what kind of people would you be ruling over? Could you trust them? How well would you sleep at night? Any time a report came in of work done or situations set up, could you be sure that what you heard or read was accurate? And your personal security, you'd be surrounded by guards that you know good and well are scheming against you behind your back, and will do you in for drug money the first chance they get. And do you want to take your complaints to a judge in court? Do you have enough money to buy both judge and jury? And even if you do, will they stay bought? And dealing with the lawyers, don't get me started down that road. Rule in hell? Uneasy lies the head that wears that crown. Angie Fenimore, Beyond the Darkness, previously cited, defines hell, quote, "Hell, while also a specific dimension, is primarily a state of mind. When we die, we are bound by what we think. God won't change us, remember. He won't interfere with our personality and agency. We are gathered together with those who think as we do. This ordering is completely natural and is consistent with how we choose to live while we are in this world." Further, it's not a black and white up or down division. There is a gradual descent or ascent from one to the other. This is illustrated in Life in the World Unseen, previously cited, page 39, wherein a relatively good man, Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson, travels from his levels in paradise down to the lowest depths. His journey, quote, "As we proceed slowly from our own realm towards these dark lands, we shall find a gradual deterioration taking place. The flowers become scanty and ill-nourished. The grass is parched and yellow. The light steadily diminishes until we are in a gray land, and then comes the darkness. We have come to the lowest plane of human existence," page 39. "Finally, there is no vegetation at all, and no light. Only those equipped with a spiritual sight can make out boulders, canyons, and figures dwelling therein. He describes the rocks as covered with a loathsome slime. The inhabitants here had lived lives of, quote, spiritual foulness, and their current residence is symbolic of the ways they lived while in mortality," page 40. They approach one of the inhabitants and describe him thus, quote, "What remnant of clothing it wore might easily have been dispensed with, since it consisted of nothing but the filthiest rags. The limbs were so thinly covered with skin that one fully expected to see bare bones showing forth. The hands were shaped like the talons of some bird of prey. The face upon this monster was barely human, so distorted was it and malformed. The eyes were small and penetrating, but the mouth was huge and repulsive, with thick protruding lips set upon a prognostic jaw and scarcely concealing the various fangs of teeth," page 40. Benson, through his near-death contact, Sir Jonathan Anderson Bart, surmises that this individual had been in the spirit world several hundred years, judging by the style of the remnants of his clothing. Quote, "He had spent the greater part of this earth life inflicting mental and physical tortures upon those who had the misfortune to come into his evil clutches. Every crime that he had committed against other people had, at last, reverted to and descended upon himself. When he was upon earth, he had acted under a false pretense of administering justice. In very truth, his justice had been nothing but a travesty, and now he was seeing exactly what true justice really meant," end quote. Page 41. "And how can someone live in this misery when they knew so much power, luxury, and authority in the mortal flesh?" Quote, "Not only was his own life of wickedness continually before him, but the features of his many victims were ever passing before his mind, created out of that same memory which is registered unfailingly and ineradicably upon the subconscious mind. He can never forget. He must always remember. He had judged himself and condemned himself, and now he was suffering the punishment he had solely and entirely inflicted upon himself." Page 41. Is there a way out, even for one such as this? A resounding yes comes. Quote, "We could do nothing but hope that one day this dreadful being would call for help in true earnestness and sincerity. His call would be answered unfailingly. Every soul who dwells in these dreadful dark realms has the power within himself to rise up out of the foulness into the light. He must make the individual effort himself. He must work out his own redemption. But the golden opportunity of spiritual reclamation is ready and waiting. He has but to show an earnest desire to move himself one fraction of an inch towards the realms of light that are above him, and he will find a host of unknown friends who will help him towards that heritage which is his due as a son of God, but which in his folly he cast aside." Page 43. Though not the literal lake of fire and brimstone, it is real, and is a place of serious suffering. Lundahl and Widdowson's The Eternal Journey, previously cited, has a chapter devoted to it, and here are some excerpts. They quote Don Brubaker's near-death experience, page 230 through 232, who descended into hell during a heart attack. It wasn't so much that he was evil, but rather that God wanted him to experience hell, then come back and testify of its reality. Quote, "You will first experience hell to prove to you the reality of evil. You've only believed that there was goodness. You must see for yourself that hell is real, and then you can tell others about the awful reality of hell and about the beautiful glory of heaven. You must tell others about me and Satan. You must make them understand that there are very real choices they must make." Strangely, it's easy enough, it would seem, to escape hell. Quote, "There were bedraggled beings shuffling along in the dark, damp, musty cave, blindly following each other, convinced that they were trapped in their sins and could not be saved." End quote. Don knew that if they would just look up to God, they could be saved from eternal enslavement, but they resisted. They had been so blinded by Satan that they could not believe that God would or could forgive them. They are prisoners of their own doubts and feelings of worthlessness, not prisoners of God. Blinded by satanic philosophies, they could not, they would not, accept the fact that they could escape, that there was a God who could save them. Page 232. Many other near-death experiences tell of these dark realms where the light shines just above the inhabitants, but they don't have the heart to look up to it and gain release. It reminds me of the story of Moses and the children of Israel who were suffering death from an infestation of venomous snakes. Moses held up a brass serpent for the people to look at with the promise that if they did, they'd be healed. Some did and were healed. Some refused. All we have to do is look. It's worth a try. Such an incredible promise for so little effort. Reference on this is in the Old Testament, the book of Numbers, chapter 21, verses 4 through 9. The bottom line, heaven is real, and so is God. But hell is also real, and so is Satan. Love is the essence of heaven, and everything else leads us away from the love of God. Previously cited, page 233. As to the reality of Satan, or the chief angel of hell, this quick look at him comes from Nibley's An Approach to the Book of Abraham, as he cites old Abrahamic legends. Quote, "The Satan of Abraham traditions is no fantastic monster with claws and horns. He is a handsome, well-dressed man and a persuasive speaker. He can be recognized not by frightful deformities, but by a, 1, disturbing eye, 2, a haughty spirit, and 3, a proud mind." Page 465. Brigham Young had this to say of Satan, quote, "I will defy any man on earth to be more gentlemanly and bland in his manners than the master spirit of all evil. We call him the devil, a gentleman so smooth and so oily that he can almost deceive the very elect." Journal of Discourses, Volume 12, page 128. Quote, handsome, smooth, oily, well-dressed, persuasive speaker. Here's a guy who could run for high office under our current political systems and probably win. As a matter of fact, they probably already have. The Egyptians claimed that Lucifer is denied many of the major pleasures of mortality and eternal life, such as posterity, one's own house and grounds, soul, intelligence, body, shades, words of power, healthy members, proper tombs, fields, trees, plants, water, bread, fire, warmth, children, relatives, head, arms, legs, ears, seed, seeing the sun every day. Nibley, one eternal round, page 29. I do have one small hope of a personal hell. I fantasize there's a special place that has been thoroughly trashed. The public facilities are smashed, there's graffiti and garbage, soiled diapers are strewn about, and one can't walk barefoot on a beach or alongside a stream because of the broken beer glass. Every creek and riverbed will be loaded with abandoned cars, tires, mattresses, refrigerators, and the like. To this place will be sent those who think of this world as their personal garbage can, who, for sport or whatever thrill they get from it, smash public facilities so they can't be used. There will be no animals, fish, or insects except those that can live in landfills and garbage dumps, such as flies, rats, and cockroaches, to whom such environments would be paradise. Upon arrival, the candidate sent there will be given a shovel and a supply of garbage bags and told to either clean it up or live in the equivalent of the mess they left behind. Now, Lord knows I'm not a tree-hugging environmentalist. I've worked in the timber and mining industries, both in at least the top five for environmental devastation, but I do dearly love this earth and her beauty, and I'm sure that earth at her best is a sample of paradise. And such places exist, national parks, animal sanctuaries. God will hold us accountable not just for how we treat other humans, but for how we've behaved towards all of His creation. But first, let us consider the necessity and definition of evil, for without that, a discussion of hell is out of the context. We talk of necessary evil. It is, actually. Professor Nibley writes of evil thus in Eloquent Witness, Nibley on Himself, Others, and the Temple, pages 439 through 40. Quote, evil is in our world. Evil spoils everything, and it is everywhere. It was planned that way. We were once at one with the Father and hope to be so again, but meantime we are being prepared for a higher order of glory. Our whole life here is a state of probation. We cannot proceed into the eternities in ignorance. We must know the worst if we are to cope with the worst. We come down here to discover those weaknesses and vices that could not come out in the presence of God and angels, to dig out the nitty-gritty of our eternal existence. End quote. What then is evil? It's easy enough to say that evil is anything God doesn't like, that He's issued commandments against. Okay, that's right, but why? Again, we must unpack the emotional connotations and baggage of millennia and distill the true nature of sin and or evil. Let's set aside for the moment such words as wicked, filthy, bad. One cool-headed approach is that of Leon R. Cass, The Beginning of Wisdom, reading Genesis, page 140. In discussing the primordial sin of Cain slaying his brother Abel, Cass says, quote, the original Hebrew word for sin, shetath, comes from a root shetah, that means to miss the mark. To the morally uninstructed like Cain, it might mean simply failure. One doesn't want to write off the murder of one's brother as a simple missing of the mark, but for the general nature of sin, this definition from an original root word can take some of the emotional and connotational baggage out of the word and the concept. and missing the mark, by how much did Cain miss it? In shooting at a target, one can be a centimeter off the bullseye, a foot, several yards, or one can turn around and shoot his arrow in the opposite direction at the judge. There are degrees of missing here, and obviously they can get progressively more serious. And what is the mark that we are missing? Once again, we are created in the image and likeness of God, and anything that moves us off that ultimate target, which is Jesus Christ, our model and pattern, is therefore sin or evil. One of the early church fathers, Origen, was said to have made these statements on evil, quote, "Evil is nothing else than refusal to accept progress. Hell is what lies in the opposite direction from that of progress, a state of inert and helpless being. Hell is not lively. It is the opposite of action, energy, purpose, and motion. The devil has no real purpose. All he is trying to do is thwart someone else's purpose." Nibley, Old Testament and Related Studies, previously cited, pages 150 through 151. Using Solzhenitsyn as our guide from the first chapter, if the purpose of this life is the development of the soul, then let us define evil as anything that interferes with the development of the soul. And let's not be too radical or fundamentalistic about this. We can't be gung-ho developing our souls 24/7. There are times to kick back and enjoy ourselves and to rest. Wisely and judiciously done, recreation, and even the occasional bout of silliness and play, are important to the development of the soul. Balance. Balance. So we have sin or evil as a willful failure to progress, a missing of the mark, and my personal take that it is a lack of soul development, whether through willful foot-dragging or choosing soul-destroying activities instead of soul-building ones. As to what constitutes the development of your soul vis-a-vis mine is a matter for you to work out with God as far as such general things as talents, education, and service are concerned. As each of us is unique and only He knows our true needs, potentials, and capabilities, then He alone is the best guide for where our soul should be heading and as to what may or may not constitute evil in our specific situations. But when it comes to evil in general, there are evils applicable to all humanity. We mentioned earlier that each developing soul starts out at the lowest level of sentience possible and is given the choice to either advance or stay as they are. We've all chosen to go as far to be created in the image of God and therefore have the potential to become as He is. Not, I stress, to replace Him. That is impossible, not to mention ungrateful and rebellious, but to share in the family business from the lower levels of responsibility to even the highest levels of all. Anything that interferes with that ultimate possibility is, therefore, evil, if that ultimate possibility is what we and God desire. If we so desire, most of us won't. Only a few will make it all the way, as Jesus illustrated. Quote, "Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way, which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it." Matthew chapter 7, verse 14, New Testament. But this doesn't mean all the rest go to a flaming hell. In any large corporation on earth, there's maybe one CEO for every 2,000 employees at various lower levels. Numbers aren't accurate, they're just for illustration's sake. But in any major corporation, how many workers actually want to be the CEO? Many are content with the job they're doing and the contribution they're making. Couple that with a CEO's salary and perks, and even fewer would strive for top leadership. In the kingdom of God, we'll all have the CEO's salary and perks, for there will be no material inequalities. The top responsibilities, creating new universes and getting all levels of life in them up and running, are reserved only for those who go so far as to become one with God, in that he allows them to open, as mentioned previously, branch offices of Salvation Incorporated. Do you want that kind of responsibility? I'm not sure I do. We'll just have to see as we go, but in the meantime, I want to develop my soul as far as I can take it. Just as there are levels of life from earliest sentience to our current state, so there are levels in our current state. Many near-death experiences speak of levels of greater happiness and advancement beyond that which the temporary traveler is experiencing. The scriptures themselves mention multiple levels besides heaven or hell. Quick examples, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, 41-42 depicts the resurrection of the dead into three levels, comparable in glory to the sun, moon, and stars. He also writes of being caught up to a third heaven. If there is a third heaven, then that implies a first and second, does it not? 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 2. And so is it evil if a person comes up worthy of only the first level of heaven, and the second and third remain above him? He could have made it to the third, but something in his nature and personality balked and said, "That's good enough. I'll be happy with what I have." I think ultimately it will be no more evil than it was for your dog, who chose to remain at dog and not progress any farther in his development. But if you could have gone farther, then it will at least be a shame, if not evil. At age 74, I look back on my life, normal for this age, and think I could have been a doctor. I love biology and the medical arts and sciences, and I think I even have a gift for it. I imagine I could have done great good for the ill and suffering. I chose instead to be a disc jockey. I don't regret that choice per se. I had 20 years in a career that I loved and developed many talents therein. But I do feel I could have made better use of my talents and intelligence and contributed more to humanity. My regrets are small. I don't beat myself up over them. But in the eternal long run, multiply those regrets by infinity and see what you get. On the one hand, we have the famous ending to the poem, "Of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been." For those of us who don't go all the way, that'll be a part of our eternal baggage. Consider this metaphor. You go to your high school's 25th reunion. There you encounter the class clown, the kid who barely scraped through and was socially promoted instead of truly graduating. He's had three wives, has fathered at least eight children, none of whom he has any contact with. He works at a car wash when he shows up. He's drunk now and will be more drunk as the evening progresses. He's making passes at the women in attendance, which will degenerate into clumsy, drooling gropings as the night wears on. He is just as immature, loud, obnoxious, and irresponsible as he was 25 years ago. He has made no progress whatsoever, except for an expanded waistline and a few missing teeth from fights. All of his problems are the fault of someone else: the government, his family, the school, his friends. If only they'd all treated him differently, he could have made something of himself. What can we say of this person who seems eternally stuck in the role of high school doofus? Is he truly incapable of growing up, or is he just mired where he is for who knows what reason? And will we not meet the equivalent of these people by the millions when we pass through that tunnel of light? And will we be one of them? But if, taking a long, hard look at the duties and responsibilities of our Father, we decide, "That's not for me, I'll be happy to settle into something a bit less stressful," then this is an agency option that will be chosen, I think, by the vast majority of His children. The choice to fully function as our Father is functioning is a choice that I don't think we should either deny or accept at this point. There's way too much we don't know to make a fully informed choice. I think at this stage, we should just choose on a daily basis to develop our souls, to choose to grow in wisdom, love, and good actions, and let the future take care of itself. Is a 6-year-old child out on the playground with her friends ready to make the choices she needs to make to become a brain surgeon? No. She needs to learn how to read and do basic numbers and get along with her peers. Progressing all the way to brain surgeon is something that will evolve as her education and maturity come. In other words, let's not sweat this godhood thing just yet. Let's just take one day at a time. But as to evil, first let's fix its location. One of the great lessons Solzhenitsyn learned from his Gulag experience was the place of evil, the human heart. Quote, "The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who's willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? During the life of any heart, this line keeps changing place. Sometimes it is squeezed one way by exuberant evil, and sometimes it shifts to allow enough space for good to flourish." Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, page 168, previously cited. He elaborates on this theme in Volume 2. "Gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes through every human heart, even within hearts overwhelmed by evil. One small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of hearts, there remains an unuprooted small corner of evil." Page 615. He makes the wise observation that most political parties, revolutions, and the like try to deal with evil by eliminating their competition, which they deem evil. This never works. The only way to get rid of evil is for each individual to battle, constrict, and confine it within his own heart. We can't control that which goes on in the hearts of others, as expressed in the chapter on agency. We are allowed only our own hearts to work with, though in the capacities of parents, teachers, ministers, counselors, and the like, we may help and advise those wrestling with the darkness that is in their heart. It is important to root out as much of this evil in our hearts as we can. In Swedenborg's writing, he states, quote, "The amount of goodness we receive from God can only equal the amount of evil we have removed from ourselves as if by our own power, which is done by both working on ourselves and putting our faith in the Lord. As much as we stop doing what is evil, we become that receptive to what is good." Previously cited, page 148. This fits in with my observations in chapter 1 about life being a rose. The rose has thorns along with its blossom, fragrance, and beauty, just as the human heart has evil along with its good. It's a package deal, and we have to accept and understand the whole package if we are to see things clearly. I do realize, I said, that thorns weren't evil, as opposed to the rest of the good of the rose. You just had to be careful with them not to get stabbed. It's the same with the evil portions of our hearts. We have to wrestle with the evil in choices between it and good. Evil in our hearts is, quote, good, end quote, when it serves the function of giving us choice. Evil is created only when we put it into action. In Beyond the Darkness, Angie Fenimore observes likewise, quote, "Most of us have a combination of the two, an essence of darkness or of light, and the proportions of each shift with each thought that is conceived in our minds, with every television show we watch, with the words that we say, and with each of our interactions with other people. Even a smile can alter the balance. We have incredible power to create for good or for evil, by the substance, light or darkness, that we use to form our words and deeds, and even our thoughts," pages 131 through 132. Fenimore goes on to show the importance of fighting back the darkness in our hearts. Light and dark are as separate as water and oil. we say there are shades of gray. These exist only in our limited mortal sight. If I have a gray background on my computer, it's only because there are black and white pixels which, when blended together, give the appearance of gray. In this mortal sphere, dark and light can be closely intertwined and hard to separate, but they are ultimately different and need to be recognized, each for what it is, and the dark disentangled and pushed out. This must be done through an act of will on our part, an honest look at the darkness that is within us, a desire to halt its advance and push it back and out as needed to combat evil. It can't be done through legislation or the outside force of discipline, as Solzhenitsyn observed. Though some who cannot control their actions which stem from evil in their hearts need to be confined so they won't hurt others, obviously, that's what prisons and jails are for. Fenimore says, previously cited, page 137, quote, I understood that everything that enters in our minds influences us and can alter the balance of light and darkness within us. Around the time of my death, a suicide attempt, I had found myself attracted to morbid and dark literature, as well as television and movies of a dark nature. End quote. She concludes with a sobering warning. The war between darkness and light upon the earth has grown so intense that if we are not continually seeking light, the darkness will consume us, and we will be lost. Previously cited, page 145. Gustav Fechner, a 19th century native of Lusatia, a Slavic area, pinpointed the dilemma of continually choosing evil when he wrote, quote, The better the man already is, the easier it is for him to become still better, and the worse he is, so much more the easily is he quite ruined. For the good man has already harbored many good spirits which are now associated with him, against the evil ones remaining, and those freshly pressing for entrance, and are saving for him his interior strength. The good man does not without weariness. His spirits do it for him. But the bad man must first overcome and subdue by his own will all the evil spirits which have striven against him. Moreover, kin seeks and unites itself to kin, and flees from its opposites when not forced. Good spirits in us attract good spirits outside of us, and the evil spirits in us the evil spirits outside. Pure spirits turn gladly to enter a pure soul, and evil without fastens upon the evil within. End quote. Runes, Treasury of Philosophy, page 393. The old slippery slope is a spiritual reality. It's quite possible to get too far down that slope and not be able to claw our way back up. Make the doing of good a habit. And thus we conclude this 12th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Hell and Evil, Part 2, and we'll deal with the second half of Chapter 6. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's HAZELLEPRODUCTIONS.COM. Thank you.